types everyone has, right? Nobody knows what athletic trainers are. I get excited to tell people what an athletic trainer is. Like, I cannot think of a single medical appointment that I've ever gone to that I have not informed them that I'm an athletic trainer and let me tell you what we are and how our professions can intersect. I love those opportunities. Others can just be really tired of having that conversation and feel like, why do we have to keep having it?
Welcome to the NATA Cast, the official podcast of the National Athletic Trainers Association. The NATA Cast is your audio source for exclusive insight from NATA, our leadership, and athletic training thought leaders. This show will feature in-depth conversations about healthcare topics that interest you, the athletic trainer. Today's discussion is part of a special series titled Dedicated, in which we visit with ATs who have a passion for the profession. Whether it's in a leadership role, an AT who is making strides in research, or a member who is bringing increased awareness to the profession by working in an emerged setting. Dedicated highlights their stories and path as they advance athletic training.
Hello, welcome back to our Dedicated podcast series. I am your host, Katie Scott. I am a certified athletic trainer and staff member at NATA. I serve as the Senior Special Projects Coordinator. Today's guest, I'm proud to introduce NATA Board of Directors District 10 Director, Casey Hildebrand. Hey, Casey, thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Yes, thank you.
So, Casey, believe it or not, you were the first chair I have worked with when I started as 18 residents. I don't know if you realized that or not, but back when you were chair of the Professional Development Committee, you were the first chair I got to work with, which was really cool. You also started your District 10 directorship this past June at convention. You're also the current program director at Washington State University. So we're very excited to get to know you a little bit better on today's podcast. And I'm really excited to ask these questions. So let's get started from the very beginning. Let's go way back to when Casey was a prospective AT student. How did you first get exposed to athletic training?
So we did not have an athletic trainer at my high school, but I knew that I really liked the human body. I loved sports. It was kind of my escape to get into. And I had an injury. It wasn't even an injury. It was a condition. Nobody really knew what was wrong. Had been affecting me pretty much since the end of my sophomore year. Soccer was my main sport, but I liked to try pretty much everything. And it was a weird condition. I had a lot of really weird symptoms that people looked at me strange when I told them that I felt like my feet were on backwards and various things like that. And so I think I got into it largely because I wanted to figure out if I could solve my own problem. Then when I went to community college to start out with, I was in an exercise physiology class, and the person who taught that class was an athletic trainer, and she appreciated my questions and was like, hey, you should come try this. So I showed up, and 5 days later, I went on a 10-day road trip with volleyball, back in the day when you could do things like that. Scary, because I did not know anything. So that was really my introduction to athletic training. And then this is a kind of funny story. So I transferred to Whitworth to do my athletic training degree. And the way the transfer worked, the advisor just put me in these AT classes. And so I showed up on my very first day of classes, and the program director was like, I don't know who you are and why you're in my classes. I hadn't gone through the formal application process to actually get into the AT program, but I'm in the classes and I'm like, well, I'm not coming here if I can't be an AT student. So I basically talked my way into the program. I said, give me a semester, and if I don't prove that I belong here, then you can kick me out. And they let me stay. So
I love it. I love the tenacity.
I kind of admire the fact that I had the balls to do that, but I think I was just kind of sitting there like, this is it. I have no backup plan. So we need to figure out how we're going to make this one work.
Okay. So tell me then, as you advance as an AT student into an early professional with no backup plan, like, you're an athletic trainer in higher education. Was that always your plan?
No, it was not. So some of my, in my family, there was no wavering on decisions. You made a decision and then you stuck with it. And so I finished being an athletic trainer student and became an athletic trainer, but I wasn't sure I really wanted to clinically practice in sort of the traditional settings. I did not absolutely love standing out at 3-hour football practices. I loved the acute care, the trauma, blood, guts, deformities. That was kind of my favorite part. But I had an opportunity in my undergrad to go to Japan for 3.5 weeks on a sports medicine tour. And when we were there, we got to tour like ASICS and Mizuno and some of the big shoe manufacturing plants. And they had these amazing biomechanics labs. So I got really excited about that. I come from a very long line of engineers in my family, pretty extensive. Like, all of my husband is, my parents were, my brother is, it's pretty extensive. And so I was like, well, that could fit both of, you know, my love of the human body and what I know, along with some engineering stuff. So my master's is actually in biomechanics. But then I realized I didn't really want to spend time in a lab either. So I decided I really need to figure out what I wanted to be. So I was like, we need to get serious because we have a master's degree now and we still don't know what we want to be. So I researched 16 different possible careers I could be. This was right where is kind of the talk about higher education and athletic training was really starting to take hold, with the idea of moving to more of the accredited route as the only option and needing PhD program directors. And there weren't very many at the time. So after I eliminated some others just because of logistics, I went and I got my PhD in student affairs of higher education, which was really awesome because I got to focus very much on the academics of athletics. And so that really gave me a lot of administrative experience. I had a lot of finance classes and various things like that. So I took a very windy path to get to where I am, but I do think it was where I was meant to be.
Tell me more about that overseas experience, because I think especially now as students have their immersion opportunity towards the end of their student experience, like that's something I didn't even know when I was an AT student existed. And it just seems like a really cool thing. So how did you discover that? What made you decide that was your best route to go? And then what kind of advice can you give a current student who maybe is interested in the idea of overseas opportunities?
Yeah. At the time, it was really only offered to our at Whitworth University with our school. And so it was all AT students that I was already in the program with that we went over there. I think there was like maybe 12 of us. And honestly, I think I initially went just because of a little bit of that fear of being left out. I was like, well, everyone else is going, I want to go. And I had really not traveled. And so I thought that that would be a great opportunity. So my advice is take those opportunities because you never know kind of what you're going to learn from it. I have some, you know, one of my longest friends that I've had was, you know, we didn't really know each other very well before we went to Japan. And then we kind of totally bonded together. It was amazing to experience a different culture. It's such a beautiful culture, but so different from ours. And so it was really a great opportunity. I think my advice is just take advantage of those opportunities if you can. It's great to experience something different and just see how other people view the world and athletic training.
Would you say there was like a sense of culture shock you had to overcome during your time in Japan?
Yes, very much so. I'm not super tall, but I am 5'8" and blonde, and I stood out kind of like a sore thumb there. And so that was really interesting. They were very fascinated by me almost more than the other way around. And so that, and I tend to be somebody who has kind of a big bubble. And so that was a little bit of a, I had to adjust to that. And their food portions. That's the other big thing I remember is like we'd be really excited because, you know, we were trying to immerse ourselves in the culture, but then we'd get to have like Wendy's or something. And when you order a meal in Japan, their sizes are like, I think they were smaller than kid sizes here. And so that was another big culture shock.
It's amazing. I know what's kind of cool at this time. I don't know if you had this when you were on your way to Japan, but our international committee now actually offers international mentors. So athletic trainers who are traveling overseas can actually pair up with somebody who's signed up to volunteer to be an international ambassador. So we will link in the show notes here to this podcast to that international ambassador program, because for me, my biggest fear when I went over to Europe was, it was Europe, but there was still a culture shock.
Yeah.
Right. And then there also at times were language barrier.
Yes.
So all of that can be overwhelming at times. But yeah, it sounds
That's awesome that you have that. That we have that resource.
It's pretty cool. I definitely appreciated having that to be able just to connect with people, and then just to be able to share the fact that there is another person who shares the same profession and skill set as you, I think really helps overcome that transition. But okay. So once you got to a point, I mean, there was a point in your career path then where you kind of had to decide, okay, I'm going into higher education and I'm doing this, I'm jumping in. And as you said, you jump all in 110%. When it came time to determine the kind of terminal degree you were getting, and we're going to talk about terminal degrees versus DAT and all of that in a little bit. But for you, I know how to get a terminal degree to become a program director. How did you determine the type of terminal degree that you wanted to achieve between the PhD, the EdD, or I think it's the SCC is the third type, correct?
Yeah. And, you know, I think I was at Kansas State University for mine, and that's where I did a master's degree. And then my husband was working on his engineering degrees. And so I needed to stay at Kansas State to start that process. And I actually originally had thought I was going to do a PhD in curriculum and instruction. And then at the time, I had two different assistantships, one working as a clinical athletic trainer with their intramural program. And then I also was a research assistant in the graduate school. And it was actually through the graduate school. My mentor there was like, I think there might be a better option for you. And so I ended up kind of finding this, the student affairs of higher education, which I think was much more tailored to what I wanted to do with it. You know, I think honestly, going for the PhD versus the EdD was a little bit of that. Just the PhD was a little bit more known at the time. I think EdDs were, I mean, they weren't new, but they were not as prevalent as I think as they are now. So it was a little bit more, I think, just of a, that's kind of what happened, you know, what I happened to choose.
So you, as a program director, you have a lot of experience and part of your day-to-day involves working very closely with students, especially students in entry-level master's programs. As our AT students go into this world where they start determining their transition or their pathway to the professionalism and they decide to take a higher education route, what advice do you have for them so that they can make the best decision in determining of what kind of post-professional program do I go to? How are they different? Which degree should I pursue? What advice do you have for them as they start that exploration process?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is some internal look and self-reflection they need to do. There are, you know, so many more options of what that path might look like. And I think some of it, they need to think about what are the parts of athletic training that they really enjoy? You know, which are the ones that bring them the most joy and are going to lead them on that pathway. So if there's somebody who really likes more of the clinical aspect and doing a lot of hands-on patient care while they're doing that, you know, I think some of the clinical doctorates are really set up, you know, for your learning to take place while you're clinically working with different patient populations. So that can be a great option. I think if you're somebody who really enjoys more of the research lab experience and really, you know, coming up with great questions and figuring out how to find those answers, then maybe looking a bit more into the route that's going to require some sort of dissertation from that aspect. And then I think, you know, I think within higher education, initially it was sort of this mindset of like, well, you can't teach graduate programs if you don't have a degree higher than them. And when the DAT came online, I think there was a little bit of like, well, what is this DAT? And I think that's really up to the individual AT to articulate to the university. I know here, even that Washington State, even though we're an R1 institution, we were able to articulate, you know, one of our faculty members has a DAT and kind of the value that that brings to the program. And so I don't really think it's any of the degrees are limiting in what you can do, but I think finding the one that you're going to enjoy the most in the process.
And so just for clarification for some of our listeners, I graduated from Michigan State for grad school. So I graduated from an R1 institution. But when I was picking grad schools, that for me wasn't even something to consider. And I feel like especially for those interested in going into the research field, it's important to do so.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference in like what is an R1 institution and what are the different levels?
Yeah, and largely it's a classification that just is done by an outside entity to figure out the research productivity expectations of a university. And they look at number of publications from faculty as well as grant dollars that come into the university. And that's kind of how you get classified as that. So R1 just means that that is a high focus of your particular institution is the publication and research side of things. And the implications that can have is if you become faculty at that institution, you need to be ready for those to be some of the expectations of your job performance are going to be tied somewhat to that productivity.
So going a little bit backwards, I know we kind of talked about the various degrees that you can go to towards choosing your career path. The DAT is a degree that's still, I would say, relatively new in the field. It's been around for a few years now. But I mean, again, when I was going to post-professional school, wasn't even an option. And now it's here. What advice do you have for students? Because, you know, there can be some confusion. PhD, EdD, SCC, DAT, they're not the same. We all agree that they're not the same. But how does an athletic trainer determine DAT versus PhD? Similarities, differences, what advice do you have for people as they pursue those options?
Again, I think really figuring out what your focus is and what you want to do with your degree. Both of them are going to let you teach, but do you want to have more of a clinical impact or do you want to have more of an impact through research and developing some of those questions and answers in that manner? And so I think that's really a big difference. I think obviously, you know, we're in an age where we also need to think about time to completion as well as, you know, the monetary investment in getting either of those degrees and just really looking at what you're going to get out of that. You know, some programs are very loosely structured, which is great if that's what you're looking for. But if you're someone who needs a little bit more deadlines and timelines in order to get stuff done, that's probably not going to be a great, you know, great fit for you. And so I think a lot of it comes down to fit, you know, and which one's going to work best with you. And then I think also looking at, you know, looking at the faculty and the people who are going to be involved in your education, you know, and what they can offer you. Cause I think finding a strong mentor within either of those degrees is also a really important factor to consider.
It feels like just mentorship in general is so integral to being successful in this profession. I know I would not be where I am today without my mentors. It's a pretty agreed sentiment. We just talked to Director Davis on his podcast, was adamantly passionate about having mentors and utilizing mentors. So if nothing else, we'll link a show note to our mentorship match program on Gather, just so people want to find an easier way to match to them.
Yeah,
I think that's really important. So Casey, kind of transitioning gears here a little bit from your profession and your career towards your volunteerism. Talk to me a little bit about your first leadership role. Was it in athletic training or was it in something else? And what drove you to take that opportunity?
I think really my first leadership role was as a grad student at K-State. When I started my PhD, I ended up becoming president of the college's Graduate Student Association. And I think that was my first step. And, you know, it's funny thinking back to it, I'm not actually really sure how I became in that role. I have a feeling it was something that I didn't necessarily apply for. It was probably a conversation amongst a couple people. And it was like, we need somebody to do it. And I either drew the short straw or volunteered for it. I would say I really love to get stuff done. I live my life off of checking things off my to-do list, being productive. And I find myself a lot of times I'll initially sort of get involved in leadership because I feel like something needs to be done. And I'm like, oh, I can figure out how to get that done. There are things that make me uncomfortable about leadership. Doing podcasts is probably high at the list of things that make me uncomfortable. I don't really love standing up in front of people and talking. I know I teach, but it's somehow I can change my effort when I teach and sort of forget what I'm doing. But I think it was a great experience. One, it was really interesting because I remember I went to my very first faculty meeting because the grad student president went to it. And honestly, I was shocked. I had a very different idea of how faculty conducted themselves. And I walked into this meeting and I kid you not, I saw two people like lunge across the table at each other. I mean, it was incredibly passionate and just a totally new awakening as to, you know, a different side of what I'd seen before. I don't really enjoy that type of leadership, but I think I really like, again, I like to get stuff done. I want to empower people to feel like they have the skills to get things done. I'm much happier being behind the scenes and having other people, you know, sort of get the credit at the end. And so I think, because I know where your question is going to go as to how I became the district director. You know, when I was district secretary, I was like, this is good. I feel like I like this. I'm in the know. I feel like I'm contributing and I think I've done enough. I think that's all I really needed to do. You know, then I kind of got talked into considering the district director and didn't get it. And I was like, that's fine. Like, I'm okay. It's a sign that I should just, you know, I've done what I can and I'll find other ways to contribute. And then it came around again. And, you know, I had some people that were very encouraging and supportive. You know, honestly, it was their belief that I could do this that probably got me to run for it. Developing our strategic plan, like I don't know that a lot of people can say that, but I love that process. Like thinking up ideas and trying to figure out how to solve problems is definitely something I enjoy. Staying up and telling people about the strategic plan is probably not my favorite thing to do. So I'm glad there's other people that can step up and do that.
So it sounds like maybe the district director wasn't always like a post-it note on your wall of accomplishments to get done at some point, and somebody approached you and said, you know, we think you'd be a really good fit for this. What was the moment for you where you finally went, you know what, I'm going to do this? Because being a district director is not easy. I don't know if people realize what goes into that position. I am privileged to get to see it from the table, and I would not want to do it. So thank you, first of all, for doing it. But what made you decide to jump in there? Do you have any hesitations, any fears, any concerns? And what ultimately got you to make the jump to dedicate your time and volunteer to the profession in this way?
Yeah, lots of fears, lots of doubts, lots of wondering if the way that I thought I could contribute would be valuable or not. It's a good question. What finally tipped me over to say, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and submit my application. I worked really hard on my letter of intent because I really wanted it to be reflective of who I was. And if they wanted who I was, then I was willing to step into it. But if they wanted something different, then that was okay too. I think as I've gotten further in my career, I value authenticity, probably maybe even to a fault. I just want to know who you are and that you're going to do what you say you're going to do, and then we're going to be fine. And I have a really hard time sometimes in the more political arenas where things get a little bit shifty at times. And so I think in some ways, maybe a sign that maybe I was ready to take on this step was the fact that I have a little more confidence in who I am as a person and that I don't really feel like I need to change anymore. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I think you were still trying to figure out my place and, you know, not that I wasn't who I was, but it was a little bit easier maybe not to feel like I could stand up behind it as much as I can now.
So I'm with you on being your authentic self, but I can empathize with you on playing in the political sandbox, as I like to call it, sometimes comes with a challenge of authenticity, right? Because sometimes being too authentic makes you seem unprofessional at times. So as a new director, getting a fresh taste of this political sandbox that we all have the joy of being in, how do you balance still maintaining Casey, the authentic person, with understanding the politics that sometimes needs to be dealt with in order to have a productive relationship?
I think it's, you know, it's really picking your battles. There's a book called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F*** by Mark Manson. I think I've read that book 3 times, and I think the impetus of it, other than using bad words, is really just the idea of figuring out what you're really willing, like what you're willing to put your energy into, and then let go of all the rest of it. You know, I spend a lot of time telling students, like, you can only deal with your monkeys. Like, stop taking on other people's monkeys, put them back in the, let them deal with theirs. You only can focus on yours. And so I think that's what I've tried to do so far is, you know, I can think of a few times I've gotten a little passionate about a particular topic because it's really important to me. And I think it's not a perspective that is being shared out loud, but I think other people share it, at least people within my circles. And then I try to just do a lot of listening. You know, I am a newbie and I really want to get a lay of the land and figure out what this is all about and not step on any explosions.
So prior to becoming a district director, as I said at the beginning of our podcast, you and I met because you were the chair of the professional development committee. And as a young professional, as someone just getting into understanding the association and the different types of volunteer opportunities, the reason that you were the first chair I got to work with was because I was really interested in understanding more about the ECE and all the committees underneath it. And so that was my opportunity to get to know more about it. So for someone who maybe doesn't have the same opportunity I did to be 18 residents, talk a little bit about your role with the Professional Development Committee, the ECE in general, because I think a lot of people are interested in maybe getting involved with those committees, but aren't quite sure what they do, who they are. There's a lot, right? There's a lot.
Yeah.
So can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So I started out of the PDC committee. I really enjoyed the PDC committee because honestly, it is a committee of a lot of other committees. I feel like the way that it was organized, at least when I was chair, was the different members of the committee all kind of had their particular area that they worked in. And so it was really kind of cool and neat because I really just got to solve problems and help the individuals that were working on all their different projects without me having to take on 12 different projects all by myself. There's so many different ways to kind of get involved in education. And so if you have a passion for education or you have a passion for the direction that you think education could go, it's a great way to get involved in, you know, the educationalist is now a committee on there. And so there's just so many different opportunities. I know one thing that I really appreciate on the PDC sometimes is, you know, it's great to have a lot of different specific educators in the room, but we really, really need the perspective of athletic trainers that are not just educating in the classroom. So, you know, the ones that are serving as preceptors, are their perspectives and their challenges are really important to hear. And so I really enjoyed when we had an opportunity on the committee to engage people in that manner as well. And I've really tried to do that even in, you know, when an opening comes on an education committee, I really try to encourage not just educators to serve in those roles because I think we really need their perspectives. We could design the greatest thing in the world, but if it doesn't work for the preceptors to actually do with the students, then it's not going to go anywhere. So if it's just better to have their perspective from the beginning than put all that time and effort into something that may not practically work. And then the ECE, I know it's changed a little bit now because it's the executive committee executive council for education, which is a little bit different. But my role in that, by being chair of the PDC, it put me on the ECE. And I really appreciated being in the room for there, just one, to hear what every different committee was doing, but also just the direction or the perspective of the direction that education was taking from the NATA perspective. In my role as a program director, I very much get the Katie perspective, and you know, they're not always the same. And so it's very interesting just to kind of see how both of those can evolve and complement each other, but also have slightly different focuses.
So now having full circle, because now you are our board liaison to the ECE and our education committees, and now you've really gotten to see a full perspective. What is the biggest challenge facing AT education today? That's a loaded question, I know.
I think a couple things. I think there is a lot that we expect from students now, and the plate is so incredibly full for them that sometimes I don't know that they have the space or time to really reflect on what athletic training education means to them. It's just a constant go, 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 go. And so I think what happens is sometimes they get to the end and they're just like, whoa, that was a lot. The amazing thing is that we have so many options of a direction that students can go into as far as, you know, the first steps in their career. I am a firm believer, and my students will probably say that I say this way too much, but athletic training does not get to own the term burnout. Every profession has burnout. And often, you know, again, I'm at a Pac-12 school, and I would like to name one person that works in the athletic building that's not burnout, from the janitorial staff to the coaching staff, athletic trainers, strength and conditioning. But I think, you know, what we get to do is we get to choose how we want to practice athletic training and what kind of setting is going to work for us. And I think the nice thing now is I feel like people are getting to try out more settings and not sort of get pigeonholed. Like, well, you tried this and now that's where you're stuck. Whereas when I first started out, the option was to either be high school or collegiate. And if you didn't want to be those things, then nobody really knew what to do with you. And so I love that we have more options now, but I think we need to continue to figure out ways to prepare our students to have a basic set of skills and then still have an opportunity to think about where they might want to practice those skills.
I can't even imagine being a student right now, because when I was about to graduate, I kind of had four pathway options. Technically five. I didn't even realize higher education was an option back then for me personally, but it was professional sports, college, university, secondary school, clinic was starting to emerge as a physician extender, and then higher education. Though at the time, I didn't know that. So we'll call it four. And I was overwhelmed. I mean, if it wasn't for, honestly, my mentors helping guide me and really doing an introspective look of where am I getting my most joy, I probably wouldn't have known what to do. Now, spoiler alert, I chose wrong. I picked wrong. And where I'm at today is not where I was 8, 9 years ago. So all that to be said, I mean, I think, you know, I don't have the perfect solution to this. I know you don't have the perfect solution to it, but I do think mentorship is a huge piece towards providing support to these students so that they feel empowered to be able to make the right decision. Because the whole point is to keep them engaged and to retain them in the profession, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think too, there's still sort of this idea that once you finish college, you're supposed to know what you want to be for the rest of your life. And the rest of your life is a really, really long time. I mean, I tell people all the time, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, because I don't know that I'm where I'm at now, where I'm going to be forever, you know, until I retire. I don't know where I'm going, but I don't know if it will be here. And I think giving students the opportunity to realize that they don't have to pick forever when they graduate is also really huge. I mean, you know, I've had some students that have sat in my office and they're like, well, I don't know if I want to do clinical athletic training because, you know, I want to be able to have a family. And they're not at a point where they even have a relationship that may lead to that. And it saddens me that they're already thinking those thoughts. And I'm like, you don't have to pick a profession that's going to accommodate a family because you're stuck there. Go be something else. And then when you do need to switch up your work-life ratio, then you get to pick a different opportunity or a different setting. And so I think a lot of it's just un-ingraining this idea that we're picking something forever as soon as we pick our first job.
I think that's tough too, though, because I know I'm definitely one of those people that when I set my sights on something, I almost become tunnel visioned in a sense. which can sometimes set up for terrifyingness if you fail. Because I feel like failure isn't necessarily a scary thing, right? Like failure in some ways is good. It teaches you lessons to improve and make your next step. And in some ways, if I didn't fail at one thing, I wouldn't be in the opportunities I'm at today.
Yeah.
But going back to that, as a young professional, as a student, failure was terrifying. Because I didn't think there were other options. So what advice then could you give to mentors or other program directors who are helping to guide and mold and lead these students into this, territory?
I think it's just meeting them where they're at. You know, what is the hang up or what is the struggle? And, you know, the idea that I truly believe that if you love athletic training, then there is a profession that you're going to find that you enjoy. We just have too many options, you know, to be able to do this. And our skills are really, I know people really don't like the word transferable, but our skills are useful in other job settings too. And, you know, I always think it's interesting. I have not been a clinically practicing athletic trainer for quite a few years. And yet if people ask me what I do for a living, I always start with athletic training. I'm an athletic trainer and I'm a program director at Washington State University. It's kind of funny. I've never once told people I'm a teacher, which technically that is what my job is. It's just not what I identify with. And every day I use my skills. My patient population just happens to be students instead of, you know, industrial or collegiate or other populations. And I don't think I could do my job if I didn't have the athletic training background to know how to work with people and how to figure out what's really going on. Those skills are kind of invaluable as an educator. And so I think when you're working with students, it's just, again, making sure they understand that it's not forever.
Casey, as you've developed your leadership style over the course of your years of volunteerism, from your very first volunteer experience to your leadership now as a district director, have you learned any major lessons or major gold nuggets that you can share with developing leaders as they develop their own leadership style?
I think one of the things that has allowed me to continue in leadership is because it's really not about me. And I don't really like things to be about me. And so sometimes I feel like people think that as the leader, you're it. And I really love just helping to facilitate getting things done, figuring out how to get rid of roadblocks that might stand in the way. A lot of times the roadblocks are just perceived roadblocks. They're not actual roadblocks. You know, when I was designing the program that we have at Washington State University, there wasn't anything like this that existed at the university. And it's kind of funny when I tell people, they're like, well, how'd you figure it out? And I'm like, I spent 2 years just talking to people from everywhere, from, you know, the graduate school and the registrar and the chair of faculty senate and, you know, anybody that I could do about this is what I want to create. And I think everyone was kind of like, well, it hasn't been done before, but I mean, it sounds cool. So I don't know, figure out if you can do it. And that's what I like about leadership. Ask the questions. And then if they say no, then just figure out why it's no. And is it really a no? Or is it just because it hasn't been done before? And is there a way to move around it? And so I think that's probably what's changed, is I'm willing to ask those questions now, where when I first started out, if somebody said no, I just assumed that that was the end of the discussion. Whereas now I want to have lots more discussions about no's so that we can figure out how we can at least get them to maybes, if not yeses.
I was sitting in a leadership lecture series earlier this summer, one of our association conferences, and the speaker talked about the pros and cons of leadership. And one of the challenges he said is the higher in leadership you go, the lonelier it gets. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I do. I think I'm at that point in my career where I have to figure out if I want to move up or if I want, you know, what I want to do with that. And I think my husband actually had a really great statement when he was, because he was kind of at that same point. And he's like, if I move up, then I have to care more about the organization. If I stay where I'm at, I get to care more about the people. And I think there's kind of that fine line in leadership. I think there's also, it gets lonely also because you have the vision, you have the direction, but you don't always have the trust. And that's where the disconnect can be.
At times, though, I'm sure that in continuing your work as a leader, I mean, during the pandemic, the weight of the world probably feels like it's on your shoulders right now. And at times, I'll even say it, I hate the word, but feeling of burnt out, especially now at post-pandemic. And I just, again, you said yes to all of this probably around 2020 at the height of everything. So with that said, what fuels you to stay motivated to keep doing this? Because you are still our district director. You're on this podcast today. You're engaging with your students. So who are you leaning on? What are you doing to stay motivated and engaged to continue to fight this fight?
Yeah. You know, some days are more tough than others. I always say students are the hardest part of my job, but they're also my favorite part of the job. And it's finding the one or two students where you do feel like you've made a difference and they're willing to articulate to you that you've made a difference that, you know, I think can continue to drive you forward, you know, and showing up every day. I think my family, my kids are, so I have one that will graduate from college next week. And then I have my daughter who's a sophomore in college. And I think getting to see them and how they interact in the world and that they still have hope for the world is somewhat inspiring and brings some sense of support to doing it. I tell students this, I fully admit, I'm not very good at asking for help. And it's interesting. I always think about that because, you know, when someone asks me for help, I feel incredibly honored that they asked me for help, that they thought that I could do something to help them. I've never once had a thought of like, oh my gosh, they can't do it by themselves. You know, what's their problem? But yet that is the fear that I have in asking for help is that people are going to judge that, you know, I don't have my crap together and I can't get things done. And I know that's not right. And I've certainly worked on it, but I'm probably not very good about asking for help. I think I've improved. And so I think that sometimes, you know, sometimes you just need to take something off the plate. It's getting too hard to keep it all balanced and we got to let something go. And so figuring out what it is that you can let go of and still move forward. And I will say, you know, I kind of joke to my family, I have three jobs. So I have being a program director. I also have a part-time FTE in our health sciences campus doing some work. And then I have been all the district director duties. And you know, this is the only one that I don't get paid for, but I also, in a lot of ways, find this the most enjoyable. It's the one where I actually feel like I can make a difference. Still, I think in my paying jobs, sometimes, you know, I've hit my head against the same wall for too long. I need to find a different wall to hit.
So let's get into that a little bit, because you talked about volunteering. How has volunteering impacted your career trajectory?
I think in nothing but positive ways. I love the opportunities to learn from lots of people that I wouldn't meet if I didn't serve in those different volunteer roles. You know, I think it's an opportunity to get out of your day-to-day struggles and see something different. I think it's just sort of been infused in me. And I think it's probably come from lots of different directions, you know, bringing the mentors that I had across, you know, across my career path is just, you know, that idea of giving back. And that's just sort of a responsibility that we have. And I take it seriously, but I think it's important. And I think it can be scary to get involved in volunteering because you might feel like, well, I don't know what I can contribute, but you just stepping up and taking an opportunity to volunteer, that like that in and of itself is huge. That was all you really needed to do. The rest of it will get figured out.
Yeah, your board brother Ray and I had a great conversation about this in an earlier podcast, and that it seems like, I mean, here's what we know. We know that time, money, and respect are three of the highest values of athletic trainers, right? And it just seems like whenever we're talking to ATs who are hesitant about volunteering, time seems to be the one element where they're just concerned that they can't give their highest quality effort because of the lack of time that they have. So what words of encouragement do you have to those that maybe don't answer the call because they say they don't have time?
One, I completely respect it because I think we all need to take that into account. But I think the other thing is that we can volunteer in big ways and small ways, but it's still volunteering. And I think small ways can sometimes make a huge difference. You know, I think you need to step up to volunteer and then figure out what level of volunteer that looks like for you. And then again, be authentic with the limitations that you have. If that's, you know, if you're not able to meet all those things, but you're able to meet some of them, I think, you know, I can't imagine someone coming up and saying, well, I can do this part of the volunteering, but I can't do that part. And then somebody saying, well, then you can't do any of it, right? Like we'll take whatever, you know, whatever time you're willing to volunteer. And it may seem small, but you never know when that was going to be, you know, that was the tipping point that caused somebody else to decide to volunteer, or just the small amount of volunteering you did infuse some enthusiasm to the other volunteers. And, you know, now they feel like they can keep going.
For sure. And I think it's important to note, I mean, selfishly, we want everyone to volunteer at NATA, right? But the reality is there's so many opportunities to volunteer that fall outside of athletic training that can be just as fruitful and engaging as volunteering within your profession too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So Casey, I do have a couple questions before we wrap up. And one of them is, I'm going to ask this to everybody on the board, but something that President Derringer holds pretty close to her heart is she is constantly wanting to leave the profession better than she found it. She's actually made that part of her mission as NATA president. So I want to ask you today, what are some of the ways that you try to accomplish this in your role as a District 10 director?
I think it's listening to the concerns that members have, you know, whether that's coming from members that have been in the profession for 30 years or ones that are, you know, newly into it and wondering what they got themselves into. I think it really is listening to them and then figuring out what changes can happen. I think the hard thing is sometimes there needs to be a perspective shift, and that can be really hard to sort of initiate. One of the biggest complaints everyone has, right, is nobody knows what athletic trainers are. And I kind of joke, and it was like, I get excited to tell people what an athletic trainer is. Like, I cannot think of a single medical appointment that I've ever gone to that I have not informed them that I'm an athletic trainer, and let me tell you what we are and how our professions can intersect, and hopefully in a way that is not abrasive to them. But, you know, I love those opportunities. Others can just be really tired of having that conversation and feel like, why do we have to keep having it? My fear is if we don't keep having it, though, we're never going to get anywhere. We need to get people to understand. And very rarely is anybody like not amazed at what we can do, which in itself is invigorating, right? If they get excited about our profession, then it's easier to continue to be excited about it.
Casey, final thoughts for our listeners today.
Keep looking for ways to get involved, whether it's, you know, a full-on volunteer position that has a title or just helping out in some small way. I think a lot of times, you know, that is what can drive fulfillment. And even though it does take time, sometimes it's time well spent because it might prevent some of the other burnout or feelings that you're having from kind of the day-to-day stuff that you might get stuck in your regular job. And it's kind of a great way to step outside yourself and work for something that's better. And hopefully, you know, as more and more people continue to do that, then we'll continue to grow the AT profession in the directions that I think it has the capacity to grow.
Casey, thank you so much today for your time and your thoughts and your leadership. This has been phenomenal. I know I've picked up quite a few golden nuggets to take with me on my way. For those listening, thank you for joining in. Make sure to check out the show notes. There's a lot of cool links to different resources and books and things that we've talked about on today's podcast. As always, if you've had some feedback, questions that you want to ask future podcast interviewees, tweet us, go on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, leave your comments. You can also email us at engage@nata.org. But again, Casey, just thank you so much for your time today. And I just hope everyone has another great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Dedicated, a special series of the NATA Cast. All resources mentioned during this episode can be found in the show notes or at nata.org/podcast. Listen, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to let us know what you thought or even what you want to hear in future episodes, send an email to the nata.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the NATA Cast and rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time.